Introducing Stephen Gray, investigative journalist and author on Risking It All for the Truth.
I believe your profession is on the side of the watchdogs, the truth tellers, and that at least in part, some of what you do is the same as what we do as investigative journalists. And for that reason, I want to share with you some of our key methods, things that we use to spot wrongdoing, prove wrongdoing, and be effective in getting the story out. Because effectiveness is the key. Because running a long, complex investigation, I found in a limited time, is rather like running a military campaign. So, how do we spot stories? I've always tended to think, if you know a subject and the people involved well enough, then you'll spot the flaws. So in a business, when we do business reporting, the most important thing is you need a micro grasp of the business model, the big picture. How's money being made and lost? Are there any tricks involved? Who are the key people making money and what kind of people are they? The cracks and anomalies are what we're looking for in all of that. A weakness or a difference between what's said publicly and what's really going on. In the spy world, they have the same approach. I remember an officer from the French Foreign Secret Service. He put it like this: we live off weakness. Until we spot weakness, we just sit around smoking cigars and reading the Financial Times. Sounds like a good life. But you spot those anomalies by doing your homework, bothering to read all the tiny details. Over-research, we call it. Something that few do. If something looks odd, it probably is. We work on the basis you have to become an expert very fast. When the pre-Murdoch Financial Sunday Times Insight team exposed the flaws in the DC-10 airline, they did that by hyper-quickly learning the inside functioning of the aircraft. And it's not so that you can pontificate and pretend that we're the experts. It's just so you get to put the sharpest questions and to talk to insiders in their language. But you also do that by getting out, which is my most, the biggest point I'd like to make. Most big secrets lie in plain sight, but you have to get out of the office to see them. When I started on Fleet Street, which was, I'd say, quite a long time ago, the best way of getting information and of developing a source was to drink yourself silly with him at lunchtime. You could reckon an officer of Scotland Yard, quite a senior one, wouldn't say anything useful till around the fourth pint. That culture has shifted a little. We now get silent officers, people listening to music on headphones, who don't just not get out the office, they don't even pick up the phone. They talk to anybody. Everything is email and texts. You probably recognize that picture. So getting out and meeting people, seeing routinely how they work and what they do, also for us avoids confrontation. Because probably like you, when you're examining things, you start with suspicions and questions. You can't just go in there with accusations. You try to understand, and you need ways of finding ways of talking to people in a gentle way. Obviously, though, unlike you, we're generally going from the inside. Let me give you an example. So in Russia, the billions of dollars, and it was billions, that we traced from contracts awarded by the state company Russian Railways. Well, what we learned was that large sums were being given to companies that appeared to be rather strange. And that revelation came from going out and making checks. So when we start an investigation, we're typically just checking things out. We can't just bandy around accusations. And I know in internal audit, you're often in the same boat. You're working inside with colleagues. And the personal routine contact you get from a visit gives you the sense of things without needing to put provocative questions. Again, when you see and go out and see something that doesn't look right, you act. Which leads me to the final point I've learned about finding stories, which is just trust your instincts. After you've met someone or looked at the numbers, you usually just feel it in your bones that something's wrong. So the next point I wanted to get onto how do we prove stories, to collect the evidence? Well, we look for different sources, people that leak information, that give us the story. And then we look for disinterested insiders, people who will talk, maybe confirm things, but don't have an axe to grind. The people with a cause are not hard to recruit. You just need to show that you're a safe pair of hands, that you will protect them if needs be. So to expose corruption on the Russian railways, we found German Gorbuntsov. He's actually a banker. And he was someone someone tried to kill at Canary Wharf. He was shot 40 times with a Makarov and survived. Pretty bad assassin, I think. And his laptop also survived. And on that laptop were all the transactions of two Moscow banks for 2 years, which were handed to us. And that unlocked a very elaborate scheme. Now, of course, Gorbuntsov told an amazing story, but he wanted revenge of sorts against the people he blamed for trying to kill us. So we needed other insiders to tell the story. So this is how we put things together, a sort of typical journalistic investigation. We started with the original crime, the assassination or the attempted assassination at Canary Wharf. We then have the area of research, Russian railways, everything about it and its leadership. We then had a knocking on doors, finding those companies that didn't exist that you saw. And then we had data research, studying the laptop and putting it all together. And everything involved and the key bits that came together all came from shoe leather, from that knocking on the doors, asking people. It's all very well having all this data, but somebody needs to make sense of it all. And one person can cut through all those complexities. One key person, funnily enough, came as we pounded the streets of Moscow, knocking on the doors of people who you don't expect to talk to you. Nominees, minor officials. One day we opened the door to someone in their underwear, and we said to him, "Is it true you own a company that receives hundreds of millions of dollars from Russian railways?" And he says, to our surprise, "Yes, that's true. But it's just a vast money laundering operation." Okay, and there was our insider, someone from then on codenamed Mr. Underpants, who was what we were looking for, a truth teller without a grudge. And it just came from asking the questions, knocking on door after door, again and again. And sometimes that's boring until you get the breakthrough. But back to human sources again, a key factor in establishing trust with an insider is to establish a friendship, to prove that you as a gatherer of facts are neutral and a normal human being, that you can be relied on to preserve a confidence and don't have your own agenda. While crucially, you can't be relied on to do nothing if some of wrongdoing is proved. And time again, what I've found really striking is that whatever the organization we're up against, and in this case, going back, that was the CIA, supposedly the world's greatest intelligence organization, provided you act professionally, there are always people, there are always insiders who will speak to you, provided you act reasonably. It also helps to be mildly entertaining. If you want to bore for England and ask endless questions about work, at some point, people will give up talking to you. You have to deal with the fact that for most people, work isn't everything. And so to get along and to get a flow of information, you have to be able to keep people mildly amused. And once I had I approached someone who said he wouldn't speak to me, would I like to go flying? So I had to prove that I could go on a stunt plane and survive a Cuban roll without throwing up. And only then, when I landed, he said, "Okay, what do you want to know?" So an interesting path. And one thing we run up against, and you may too, is finding that conduct is excused as something that's wrong, but it's legal, and that it comes in different shades. You may think it's wrong, for example, for Ryanair to charge for wheelchairs, but at least Michael O'Leary is upfront about it. But deliberate dishonesty is almost always at some level fraud. And if it comes out, you or your bosses may not go to jail, but they are likely to be toasted alive in public, and it may destroy the value of their brand. It's true that some people get fabulously rich, even become leaders of the free world, by trading on glaring loopholes. But don't bank on it. For most of us, it ends badly, at least for the employees of the companies we look at. So how things should work is that when something legal but wrong is exposed, the law is changed to make it illegal. But in a corrupt system, that doesn't always happen. But still, you have to decide, and we all have to decide, because if no action is taken, no whistle is blown, the result can be catastrophe. If a company collapses, customers flee, investors go broke, and it's no great consolation to say afterwards, no laws were broken in the making of this disaster. We do need better protection for whistleblowers to reduce the danger of truth-telling. But that can't take away the fact that confronting something wrong always takes courage, even if it's your job to do so. And so, what if we do the right thing and act on our concerns, even in a quiet way? Will it matter? When some people are rewarded for lying, or when apparently egregious revelations hardly cause a stir, you can sometimes ask yourself, is it really worth it? Am I making an impact? Sometimes, though, truth just chips away at a pillar that props up wrongdoing. Or to change the metaphor, in your jobs, if you can recommend the change of course that steers the Titanic away from the iceberg, perhaps you'll stop a disaster, and no one may know what you've avoided happening, but you've done something very important. Some of the most important revelations change the whole terms of debate. They change the way we think about things, and it could be quite a while before other people notice or care. Singing your lonely tune doesn't make you wrong. Back in 1999, to give you an example, I was part of a team of journalists that from different countries that investigated corruption in the European Union. We were quite widely derided as troublemakers and quite wrongly as anti-European. Well, I think if Europhiles hadn't seen all the criticism of fraud and mismanagement as a criticism of the whole European project, we wouldn't be quite where we are today. But our colleagues in those days tried to ignore those stories. But in the end, the story snowballed so much that in 2000, for the first time in the Union's history, the entire European Commission, led by Jack Sonte, resigned. And that was the result of us ploughing alone when no one thought it was much of a story at first. On the other hand, joining a media bandwagon can cause great harm. There's a difference between good teamwork and groupthink. Bad so-called investigative journalism called the MMR vaccine a danger and has led to a wave of measles outbreaks. But a key lesson I've picked up is patience. The point is, don't get disheartened if no one appears to listen. When I started reporting the CIA rendition program, what they called the torture program, it was at first hardly noticed. I remember trying to sell the story to 60 Minutes. That's one of the most famous US investigative TV shows. And they said to me, and this is the atmosphere after 9/11, are you sure these people are innocent? I was like, no, I'm not sure, actually. But I just think torture's wrong. And that's not going to work with our editors, so they wouldn't touch the story. At that time, it's about the mindset, changing the mindset. Eventually, the mindset did change, and the story caught on. 60 Minutes were on the phone. They actually wanted to make a film. And it was taken up, the story, by the European Parliament and written about in thousands of articles. I heard indirectly from someone at the CIA that our reporting, mine and others, had cost the agency over $1 billion. They'd had to make a new airline. But more seriously, the agency did change, was stopped in its tracks. It changed its policy. So it made a difference. But the key thing was, just because people didn't take it seriously as a story at the beginning, didn't mean that ultimately it wouldn't be important. It just takes time for truth to have an impact. Above all, I want to emphasize how uncovering facts, correcting the wrong course, is worth it. Yes, you can be blown up in Europe for telling the truth, but frankly, the risks are far, far smaller in our country, in Britain, in Ireland, and most of Western Europe. But in taking action here, it makes it safe for others elsewhere. So what could cause you a minor hiccup could get your colleague in Sri Lanka, in Russia, or in Mexico put in jail or killed. Sometimes we do have to put our career, our reputation, even our pension on the line. But if we do, we not only do some good, we may also stop far more serious things happening to others. So let's rock the boat. Thank you.